This paid program may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to a special edition of the Business of Government Hour, a conversation with authors. I'm Michael Keegan, your host and managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. For the last 15 years, the IBM Center for the Business of Government has sought to connect research to practice, sponsoring third-party research on a broad range of public management issues facing us today. The U.S. federal government provides assistance to eligible populations through a variety of targeted programs. Today, we'll discuss a topic that does not receive significant attention, the role of outreach organizations in assisting government agencies to determine benefit eligibility of citizens applying for services. We will do this with Professors Lael Kaiser and Susan Miller, author of the IBM Center Report, Collaboration Between Government and Outreach Organizations, a case study of the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. In this report, Kaiser Miller examines a large government program with a long history of complex interactions with outreach organizations. What are the roles of state veteran agencies and veteran service organizations such as the American Legion and the Disabled American Veterans in working with the Veterans Disability Compensation Program at VA? What dynamics lead to effective collaboration between outreach organizations and government programs? We will explore these questions and more with Professors Kaiser and Miller. They will outline five strategies that can further enhance the benefits between federal agencies and outreach organizations. Welcome, Professor Kaiser.
Thank you.
And welcome, Professor Miller.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, Professor Kaiser, your report for the IBM Center, Collaboration Between Government and Outreach Organization, a case study of the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, addresses a topic that does not really receive significant attention, and that is the role of outreach organizations in assisting government agencies to determine benefit eligibility of citizens applying for services. I really am interested, what are outreach organizations and how do they differ from so-called third-party assistance organizations? And more particularly, what types of programs do these organizations facilitate?
Outreach organizations help educate people about government programs and help them apply. They are especially used when eligibility rules for different programs are complicated or when the application procedure is complicated. And they're used in a whole bunch of different programs. Examples would be the Affordable Care Act, for example. The federal government gave grants to a lot of community groups to assist people in filing for health insurance through the exchanges that set up through the Affordable Care Act. That would be a really sort of example that is in the news right now. Other examples would be with SCHIP. So when the government expanded Medicaid for children, they gave a lot of grants to community organizations to help people sign up for Medicaid. And you also even have some of these organizations many of these organizations are not for profit, but some are actually for profit. So another example would be that 18 states right now have given a contract to a for-profit company called the Public Consulting Group. And that group contacts residents of states that are receiving temporary aid to needy families and helps them apply for Social Security disability. So there's a whole set of these organizations that range from nonprofits to for-profit. Some are getting government contracts to do this work. Some are doing it just on their own. So, for example, a lot of non-for-profit groups like Catholic Charities that serve low-income families, they will provide these types of services for all the different types of programs that those families are eligible for. So that could be for, you know, temporary to needy families. It could be the earned income tax credit. It could be, you know, Medicaid. So it could be any type of application that they need help with. They're very active and in a lot of programs, and there's a lot of different types of organizations that would qualify under that label. They differ because the third-party assistance programs are the nonprofits or for-profit organizations that directly provide the service, the government service. So the government funds provides the funds, but it's the nonprofit or for-profit that directly provides the service. So examples would be job training. So through the Workforce Investment Act, the federal government provides money to provide job training to certain populations. And that job training is not provided by the government directly, but it's provided through a nonprofit or a for-profit organization.
Professor Kaiser, would you tell us how outreach organizations typically assist government agencies? What aspects of a program can be enhanced from effective collaboration between these government agencies and the outreach organizations?
Well, they typically assist applicants by first even informing them about the program in the first place. So there are a lot of government programs that maybe people who actually meet the eligibility criteria just are unaware of. And so outreach organizations can help to educate potential applicants that this program exists and help the government better serve the population that it's trying to target through the program. They also, these outreach organizations can help them collect and file the necessary documents. Some of these programs require lots of different documents, and especially when it's dealing with something that is related to disability or something like that, there's a lot of documents related to providing evidence of certain medical conditions. And so outreach organizations can help the applicants in providing all that information. By doing this, they actually also help the government agency process claims more quickly, because if it's working the way it should, the government workers who are trying to determine whether or not the applicant is actually eligible for the program has a much more completed application to work with. When they don't have completed applications, then it's the government employees who have to try to develop the claim and gather evidence, and that increases the time that it takes to process that claim, and it can increase backlogs and just slow down their whole processing. So outreach organizations can really assist in helping the whole process be much more timely.
So, Professor Kaiser, by performing these outreach activities, state and local governments, nonprofits, and other organizations, what we've referred to here as outreach organizations, how do they have the potential to impact the performance of government agencies in implementing benefit programs? And more particularly, how can government agencies better engage outreach organizations?
When you think about the programs that serve populations where they have to determine whether or not particular people are actually meet eligibility criteria, one of the things that we care about is how quickly they can make those decisions. And so, in a sense, that's one way that we think about them as being effective or ineffective. And this has really important implications for people because, you know, if you're in need, how long you have to wait to get a decision from a government agency has a big effect on your well-being. And so governments are always trying to process those claims as quickly as possible. And so that is a way that it improves the effectiveness by improving timeliness. We also talk about in the report other ways that they can generally improve performance. So not only are we concerned about timeliness, but we're also concerned about how accurate the decisions are. And presumably, outreach organizations can help improve accuracy of government agencies by alerting managers when there is a problem. So if there is some government employees maybe who are misinterpreting eligibility criteria, outreach organizations can alert a manager that is the case. And the manager then can look into it and, of course, make their own determination about whether or not they actually are misinterpreting eligibility criteria. But it sort of gives the manager another set of eyes. You know, it's another group of people who are kind of looking at how applications are being decided, and that can inform them when something is going wrong and maybe the agency is actually making decisions that are not consistent with the regulations. So that's one way that they can actually improve performance as it relates to accuracy. And then the third sort of general point that we make about how it improves accuracy is that working with outreach organizations can improve customer service. And what we mean by customer service is just sort of how applicants are treated. Because regardless of whether or not somebody actually is eligible for the program, you want government agencies to treat those people with respect. And, you know, if there ever is a case where the applicants are feeling like they're not being treated with respect, or outreach organizations know, you know, can see that they're not, that allows them to communicate to managers that there's a problem, and that managers can then address that within their government agency.
One primary goal, Professor Kaiser, of outreach organization is increasing access to government programs. These outreach organizations often play advocacy roles similar to those played by interest groups, which presents sort of a conflict with program stewards, the program owners. Would you elaborate on the conflicts among outreach organizations and government program managers, and how are these issues and conflicts ameliorated?
Well, in general, outreach organizations have a much more narrow mission than government agencies do, in that the outreach organizations, their primary purpose is to help people apply for benefits and to get those benefits. And they're not primarily concerned about protecting taxpayer dollars, or they're not necessarily, I mean, they can be, but they're not necessarily concerned about how they do with one particular applicant may affect all applicants. So, for example, if you were in an outreach organization and you saw yourself as your primary purpose being to just make sure that everybody you're working with receives the benefit, you may encourage them to file misleading information, or you may encourage them to file in ways that maybe may increase their likelihood of getting the benefit, but may also slow down the process for other people. And so the fact that the government employees, they have to worry about best serving the applicant, but they also have to worry about protecting taxpayer dollars. And so if people in outreach organizations are viewed by government employees as primarily just trying to get as many people on benefits as possible, they're not going to trust them enough to work with them in a collaborative way. And so you won't have these positive impacts that we know in the report that you can have for increased collaboration. So one thing that we found that in our doing these interviews, though, with the veterans issue, is that there are very specific ways that you can get around these problems. And so there's particular ways that the outreach organizations can develop a reputation as being what they refer to as honest brokers, which that they actually see their mission a little bit more broadly than just assisting individual applicants. Instead, they see their mission as educating applicants about the eligibility criteria, including what they may not be eligible for, and trying to make sure that people who actually meet the eligibility criteria file for the things that do make them eligible. But if they see somebody who isn't really eligible for something and they know that they're honest with them and tell them that they shouldn't waste time filing for that claim. And so, you know, just by having the mission or the orientation of having a broader mission, that can really help to develop a reputation that makes the government employees more willing to work with the outreach organizations.
Professor Kaiser, what are the benefits and costs associated with collaboration in eligibility-based programs?
Some very sort of specific things. So in all of the things that we talked about that were had potential things that could help improve the process, there also was a possibility that collaboration would actually be problematic for those things. So just using the example of timeliness, for example, if you had a lot of collaboration between an outreach organization and a government agency, it's possible that that could actually reduce timeliness if the employees in the outreach organization started to take up a lot of time for the government employees. So if the government employees suddenly have to spend all their time responding to people in outreach organizations, that's taking them away from their core task of developing and processing claims. So if it's distracting to them, or if they're having to spend most of their time responding to outreach organizations, and if outreach organizations are not sort of careful about using up their time, you could actually have it reduce timeliness. Or if outreach organizations are encouraging applicants to file misleading information or appeal decisions, you know, regardless of the merit of the appeal, all of those things would just, you know, increase the amount of work that the government agency has to do without actually improving the service that they're providing. So it can have a negative effect, and that's why it needs to be managed carefully.
So, Professor Kaiser, what dynamics lead to effective collaboration between these outreach organizations and the government program manager?
Well, I think the biggest sort of takeaway point, or that people mentioned a lot, is good quality communication. So from the perspective of the government agency, managers that communicated with the outreach organizations, that helped to facilitate good relationships. And so when I talked about sort of in communication can really lead to increased trust. And the problems with a lack of trust come from each organization thinking that the other has a contradictory mission. And so anything that the managers or the outreach organizations can do to sort of highlight the fact that they actually do have shared goals is a good thing. So just, you know, some specific examples is the outreach organizations, if they establish a reputation, as I mentioned before, as being an honest broker, that can really help to facilitate collaboration because the government agency employees will be willing to work with them. And one specific thing that we heard about in our interviews is one of the supervisors of a veterans organization, he actually took into account whether or not his employees worked to collaborate in an effective way with the government agency as part of their performance. And what he meant by that was if they were doing things that would just sort of were filing things, you know, just filing things that gum up the system is sort of the words that he used, that was something he took into account. So he really tried to encourage them to think about their job was to try to help make the claims processing go more smoothly for the government agency. And he used that in evaluating their performance. So that's just sort of an example of how an outreach organization can develop a reputation of being a quality collaborator and help facilitate that relationship. And conversely, on the side of the government agency, we saw an example of a director who in a meeting highlighted to his employees that their primary purpose is to serve veterans, or one of their primary purposes is to serve veterans, by just asking all of his employees to stand up if they were a veteran, and then to stand up if they had a family member who was a veteran, or to stand up if they had a friend who was a veteran. And by the end of this, all of the employees in the VA had stood up. And the veterans organizations, they weren't even present at this meeting, but they heard about it. And that made them have a high level of trust in that director. And they sort of believed that director was acting in good faith to serve veterans and was doing everything possible to try to, you know, improve the performance. And that really made, you know, having that better trust made the interactions that they had more positive.
How did the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs and veterans organizations collaborate? We will explore this question and so much more when our special edition of the Business of Government Hour, A Conversation with Authors, returns. How can DoD improve its acquisition processes? Check out the latest IBM Center report, 8 Actions to Improve Defense Acquisition. The authors emphasize the urgency of acquisition reform in DoD, given budgetary constraints and security challenges, finding that DoD will need to gain every possible efficiency while resisting the temptation to buy defense on the cheap. This report continues the IBM Center's interest in better understanding and improving the federal government acquisition process. Download your free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Government leaders and managers face major challenges today, including fiscal austerity, citizen expectation, the pace of technology and innovation, and a new role for governance. These challenges influence how government executives lead today, but more importantly, how they can be prepared for tomorrow. The IBM Center report, 6 Trends Driving Change in Government, offers a path forward for government executives responding to the ever-increasing complexity and challenges they face today. Download your free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to a special edition of the Business of Government Hour, a conversation with authors, exploring ideas for improving government effectiveness. So, Professor Miller, I want to turn to you. You examine a large program, the Veterans Disability Compensation Program, which has a long history of complex interactions with outreach organizations such as state veteran agencies and veteran service organizations, VSOs. Would you provide a brief overview of the history and the process of the Veterans Disability Compensation Program, which VA runs?
Sure. So disability benefits for veterans in the U.S. have been around for a really long time, really since the Revolutionary War, and even before that in the English colonies. Around World War I is when we start to see the more modern version of disability compensation. So in 1919, Congress started to use the word compensation instead of pension in order to indicate these payments were for an objective indemnity for loss instead of a subjective gratuity. And then in the early years of FDR's presidency, he wrote a lot of the language that we still use, that is still used to govern the modern veteran disability program. They've had a long, complex relationship, the veterans organizations and the VA. So the veterans organizations, many of them started around World War I or a little bit before, and they have worked in order to make sure that veterans received compensation in order to, they worked also to increase the compensation that was received by veterans for their service. They also worked, so at one point FDR actually attempted to combine veteran disability compensation with other disability programs, and the veterans and the veterans organizations opposed this change, and they ultimately succeeded in keeping the veteran benefits separate. In terms of process, like any government program, so first the veteran files a claim for disability benefits. Most or a majority of veterans actually use a representative either from a veteran service organization or private attorney to file their claim. The second piece of the process is after the application is filed, the claim starts moving through the rating process. And so this is where additional evidence might be needed. So the veteran may be asked to go through a physical examination or to supply additional evidence in order to support their claim. And then the third piece is the rating decision is made and the veteran is notified. So the veteran is told whether their claim is approved or denied and at what level their claim is approved or denied. So veterans' disability compensation claims, they receive disability at a percentage, and then it goes from 0 to 100 in 10 percentage point increments. And so the veteran can apply for a certain level and then receive a level that's lower and then, you know, try to go back and appeal. So if the veteran is satisfied, then that concludes the process for that particular claim. And if the veteran is unsatisfied with the rating decision, then they can appeal the decision through a separate appeal process. They can also, after some time goes by and if their disability worsens, the veteran can actually reopen their original claim, which then allows them to maybe get a higher disability rating than they received originally. So that's kind of just the basic process that's gone through.
So, Professor Miller, would you tell us more about the state veteran agencies and veteran service organizations? What roles do they play in the implementation and function of this program? And what activities do VSOs engage in to assist veterans?
Okay, yeah. So let me first describe the VSOs and the state veterans agencies. So the veterans organizations are a non-governmental organization, such as the Disabled American Veterans or Veterans of Foreign Wars or the American Legion. And these are organizations that are recognized by the VA to assist the veterans in disability compensation claims. And so these, some VSOs have accredited service officers in all VA regional offices across the United States, while others are more regional in nature. And in order to obtain their help, veterans actually don't have to be members of these organizations that represent them. State veterans agencies are, you know, agencies of the state government, and they're also recognized by the VA to represent VDC, or Veterans Disability Compensation Claims. And almost all states maintain veterans agencies that are recognized by the VA for this function. They serve a really integral role in veterans disability compensation. They first provide outreach. So they go out and they help veterans understand what veterans disability compensation is and whether or not they are eligible. So they go out and find the veterans. And then they also help veterans actually file their claims. So filing for government programs is a really complex process. And these organizations have trained personnel who are there to help veterans navigate the application process and then possibly the appeals process if that's necessary. So the veteran service officers are actually often the first people that the veterans meet when they come into the VA regional offices, because they're the ones who often are going to help the veterans actually file those claims. Some people joke that they actually thought that, that many veterans actually thought that the veteran service officers were actually VA employees because they work in the same offices usually, and they're often the first people that the veterans meet when they come in. And many VA supervisors noted that their job would be impossible without the veterans organizations, because the veterans organizations really do help to serve as kind of the first communication point for the veterans and the VA, and really help to explain what the process is to the veteran. And that takes that burden off of the VA personnel, so that the VA personnel can really focus on getting through and rating disability compensation claims.
So, Professor Miller, would you outline the Veteran Disability Compensation Program's eligibility determination process? More particularly, is eligibility linked to income or employment status? And could you tell us how compensation payments are determined?
Sure, yeah. Eligibility is not linked to income or employment status. Again, it's seen as an indemnity for loss, so it's really not linked to any kind of income or status. So under the current disability compensation program, eligibility requires that a veteran was discharged or released under conditions other than dishonorable, and that a veteran's disease or injury was incurred or aggravated in the line of duty. And so this means that the burden is really kind of on the veteran to show that there is a link between their disability and their service, their time of service. Compensation payments are based on the disability rating schedules that rates each disability in 10% increments, like I mentioned before. And the amount of compensation that is given to the veteran increases as the veteran's level of disability increases. So that's kind of the general overview of the process. In fiscal year 2012, over 3.5 million veterans received disability compensation, and the average annual disability compensation payment was $12,500.
Interesting. So what are the key challenges facing the Veterans Disability Compensation Program?
So I think that one of the major challenges that we all are aware of is the high demand. So we have a lot of veterans coming home from our operations overseas in Iraq and Afghanistan. So there's a lot of demand placed on the VA in order to process these claims quickly. And not only process these claims quickly, but also process these claims accurately. And so there's a balancing act that the VA has to go through in trying to process the claims as quickly as they possibly can, but also as accurately as they possibly can. Because in processing the claim, the original initial claim quickly, if they do it quickly but not accurately, then that's going to create an additional backlog at the appeals process. So you're going to have a lot of veterans who are not satisfied with their original decision, and then they're going to come back and appeal that original decision, and that's going to create an additional element of problem. So the trying to balance the timeliness and the accuracy of the claims process. There's also some issues that the VA faces in terms of presumptive diseases. So these are diseases that the VA assumes are related to a veteran's qualifying military service. So these are certain kinds of cancers or other health problems that may be associated with, for example, exposure to Agent Orange. And so these also really increase the number of claims that are filed, because once the VA announces these kind of presumptive diseases are included, then that increases the number of claims that are going to be filed for veterans who have these kinds of diseases. So these are some of the challenges that are facing the program currently.
So, Professor Miller, the findings presented in your report for the IBM Center are based on interviews with over 40 individuals. Would you elaborate on each of these findings?
Sure. The findings that we come to in the report that are based on the interviews, there are a lot of findings that we really couldn't have come to, a lot of the conclusions that we really couldn't have reached without talking to the VA personnel and without talking to the personnel of the veterans organization. So some of the important things that we learned through all of our interviews was really the importance of building trust. So this is something that you can, you know, before talking to people, you can kind of assume, but actually after talking to personnel from both sides of the aisle, it became very, very clear that without trust, there really isn't the potential at all for effective collaboration. We heard a story from one supervisor who had had a bad experience 15, 20 years ago, he was a VA supervisor, and he had a bad experience with a staff member from a veterans organization. And then for the next 15, 20 years, he didn't really work with the veterans organizations because from that bad experience, he had developed a kind of a bad impression of all veterans organization personnel, and then really didn't that didn't allow for him to take advantage of the potential benefit of working with the veterans organizations. And so building this trust and maintaining a good rapport with the people from the different organizations, so either from the VA or the veterans organizations, is really important and something that we probably really couldn't have understood without doing these interviews. Another finding that was really important that came out of the interviews was the point about having a lot of training. If you have enhanced capacity, so if the veterans organizations or the VA employees, if they are well trained, then the other personnel from the other organization want to work with them. And it allows for better collaboration because if you see someone from another organization as being really helpful to you in your job, then you're going to really want to work with them and you're going to actually seek them out. Whereas if you see someone as not really having a lot to offer, then you're not going to utilize them in the way that is going to be most effective if they could be utilized in that way. And so the idea that both sides of the aisle needs to have a lot of training and be well qualified was something that really came across during our interviews.
So, Professor, you point out that the collaboration between VA and Veterans Service Organization provides a model of how outreach organizations can work with government agencies to improve claims processing. The case of the Veterans Disability Compensation Program provides some specific steps that policymakers can take to reduce existing barriers to collaborative relationships between government agencies and these outreach organizations. Would you outline each of these steps for us?
Sure. So, one important thing that that policymakers did in the Veterans Disability Compensation Program was that they codified the role of outreach organizations. So within the U.S. Code, the role of veterans organizations in the claims process is actually written in law, and this gives the organizations a formalized role in the process. So the U.S. Code outlines the veterans organization's function as power of attorney for claimants and then really outlines their responsibility of the VA to the veterans organizations in this capacity. So there's no question that these groups are supposed to be involved in the process. This also led to the VA really laying out more clear and detailed regulations about the role of the veterans organizations in their claims process. And so this really helped to outline and give some detail and fill out the role of the veterans organizations. And so policymakers can codify the role of outreach organizations in this way, and they can do this in other government programs as well. Another thing that policymakers did in this program was that they provided office space for the veterans organization. So within the regional offices, the veterans organizations work in the same building as the VA claims processors. And so because of this, that allowed the veterans organization personnel and the VA personnel to build relationships and actually work together in a really collaborative function in a way that they probably would not have achieved if they had been working in different buildings. We heard a number of people mention how working in the same building led to more effective collaboration. And we also heard about the difficulties facing veteran service officers who worked out in the field that did not have an office in the same building. It just created barriers for their effectively communicating with VA personnel and for getting to know the VA personnel and really building those relationships so that then they could work with them in the future. Another thing, I guess, would be, and this may not be done at the policymaker level such, you know, at Congress. So, and not in Congress, for example, but maybe at a lower level within the organization, providing joint training. So joint training maybe between the veterans organizations and the VA personnel is a way that you can ensure that both organizations, so the VA and then also the veterans organization personnel, have the capacity that I mentioned before, how that's so vital to effective collaboration. It also allows for the Veterans Organization personnel and the VA personnel to get to know one another. And that, of course, builds trust and can lead to more effective collaboration down the road.
What strategies and actions can be taken to increase effective collaboration between government agencies and outreach organizations? We will explore this question and much more when the special edition of the Business of Government Hour, A Conversation with Authors, returns. In a world inundated with all kinds of information, timely, relevant, and more predictive data can drive better decision-making. Law enforcement agencies are at the forefront in leveraging data and using innovative software to generate predictions that help police prevent crime. What is predictive policing? How can using analytics make us safer? Check out the IBM Center report, Predictive Policing, Preventing Crime with Data and Analytics by Jen Bochner, and find out. Download your free copy at businessofgovernment.org. What do agency leaders need to know about the federal acquisition process? What are some of the key federal procurement trends? And how can agency leaders overcome today's acquisition challenges? Check out the new Center report, A Guide for Agency Leaders on Federal Acquisition by Trevor Brown, and find out. The report offers practical recommendations for improving federal acquisition. Download your free copy of A Guide for Agency Leaders on Federal Acquisition at businessofgovernment.org and find out how the business of government is not business as usual. Welcome back to a special edition of the Business of Government Hour, a conversation with authors, exploring ideas for improving government effectiveness. So, Professor Kaiser, when considering the performance of government agencies involved in claims processing, stakeholders and elected officials are primarily interested in what three things?
Well, they're very sort of similar to, I think, all government programs that deal with determining eligibility, which is that they are timeliness, accuracy, and customer service. So we thought we found very specific ways in which collaboration could affect these things. And actually, the third one is customer service is included, but it's also consistency, meaning that you don't want one applicant being treated differently than another applicant. So in terms of timeliness, I mean, I think that they're very similar to sort of the general points about how that they can improve timeliness for the agency. But I want to talk about some more sort of specific things that really sort of came out of the interviews that relate to the Veterans Disability Compensation Program specifically. And that is that there is something in the law called the duty to assist, which means that any time a VA employee interacts with a veteran and the veteran brings up a medical condition that they have, by law, the VA is obligated to investigate that medical condition that was brought up. And one thing that we heard that why collaboration can really help streamline the process is that a veteran's organization can talk much more frankly with a veteran and make sure that they want to file for the conditions that they've listed on the application. Whereas if that veteran was talking to a VA employee, if they mentioned back pain, for example, then that goes down as one of the conditions. And then the VA will not actually make a decision on that claim until they've investigated all of the conditions that are listed on the application. And sometimes veterans may not even understand that by adding lots of multiple conditions to their claim, they may actually be slowing down the process. So that's one really specific way that I think applies to this case, where the veterans organizations can really help to speed up the application process, both by making sure the veteran has the documents are included in the file that are needed, and then also by sort of better educating the veteran to file in ways that will make sure their application is processed as quickly as possible. So I think that's a good example of how they can influence timeliness. Another sort of example that we saw with increasing sort of timeliness is actually in appeals that we saw in several offices, regional offices, either through formal things or informal kinds of activities. Oftentimes, the managers in the VA would ask personnel in the VOs to just go through a lot of old appeals and to see if there's any, you know, individual pieces of information that are missing from the claim, that, you know, that the appeal is pending and nothing's being done on it just because they're missing a document. And those claims then can be, maybe they could be decided right away without even actually going, you know, through the whole appeal. And so that's just another example of how collaboration really speeds up the process. In terms of accuracy, some examples, I mean, obviously the outreach organizations, so the VOs, are another pair of set of eyes that can look to make sure nothing has gone wrong with a claim. And they can alert supervisors if they see patterns. So, for example, if they see one particular rater in the VA that they think are misinterpreting the regulations, they can bring that to the attention of the supervisor, and then the supervisor can look into it. And consistency, what the ones that we found were in terms of the positive impact was that VOs could maybe see patterns in maybe one rater was interpreting something differently than other raters, and then that would help the supervisor know that maybe they needed to train all of their raters so that people were interpreting things consistently across claims. So that's the way that they would improve consistency. So the timeliness issue, as we talked about before, it's possible that the VOs, if they're constantly contacting the VA employees, they're kind of taking them away from their core tasks, and then they don't have enough time to do their actual work. And so many supervisors believed that a better way of dealing with this was to have they call it a coach first policy, which basically means that the VOs, rather than contacting the VA employees that are directly working on the claim, they should contact the supervisor. And then the supervisor hears from all the VOs and can then go talk to the raters, you know, individually and find out what's going on.
So your report identifies five specific strategies that managers can use to increase the level of trust, expand the level of expertise and resources, and support the frequency and quality of communication among the VA and the Veterans Service Organizations. I'd like to explore each of these strategies. Would you tell us about the first two strategies and what actions can be taken to implement them?
Okay. So strategy one that we identified was highlight shared goals. And we've talked about this a lot, but one thing that we kept hearing throughout the course of our interviews was that it's important for the Veterans Organization staff members and for the VA staff members to recognize that both groups are there for the veterans, and they're both trying to improve the lives of the veterans, and they want to make the veterans, their priority. And so just highlighting that in any way that you possibly can. Lael mentioned earlier the story about how the supervisor in the VA had all of the veterans stand up, and then had all of the family of the veterans stand up, and then had all of the friends of the veterans stand up. That, again, really highlighted to all people working in the office, and so not just the VA employees, but also the VSO employees, that this person really cared about veterans and wanted to really prioritize veterans and the care of veterans. So just anything that personnel can do on either side to highlight that both are there working for the veterans, just making sure that the relationship doesn't become adversarial, making sure that the relationship between the two groups really is a collaborative one, because they are both there working ultimately for the same goal.
I just wanted to add one thing to that. A specific implementation strategy was that supervisors in the VA really can determine whether or not the frontline employees think about using the Veterans Organization as a resource. And so simple things like just talking about, like, well, you should go check with, if you're having a problem or you can't get some information, why don't you go down and ask the VO who's representing them? Maybe they can help you find the information if they can't, or if they're having trouble getting in contact with the veteran. So a lot of it is just very specific things of informing the frontline workers in the Veterans Administration that the VOs are a resource that they can use.
Yeah, exactly. And that ties in nicely with the second strategy, which is encouraging collaboration throughout the organization. And so organizational leaders, at the top level of the organization, so secretaries, VA, down all the way down to the directors and managers and supervisors within the organization, as well as the veterans organizations managers and their top level employees, can talk about ways in which they can improve collaboration, should talk about the other organization as partners, should praise employees when they see them actually collaborating and using the other organization personnel as a resource. Lael mentioned this before, but some of the VSO managers talked about how they used whether or not their employees were collaborating and actually talking to the VA and doing all that they could to make sure that they were filing claims in a way that would help the VA as a criteria on which to evaluate employees. So that's one way to encourage collaboration throughout the organization, just simply praising collaboration when you see it. So if a supervisor sees a VA employee going down to talk to a VSO employee down the hallway, then that should be praised. That should be pointed out as something that is good. And then also the manager can point out why it's good. So not just saying good job, but also explaining how the VSOs can actually help to improve the process, improve timeliness, and also improve accuracy. And so making sure that the VA employees are not only aware that it's a good thing to do, but also that it can actually improve their job performance. Managers can also, in terms of encouraging collaboration throughout the organization, managers can also find a way to take advantage of the collaborative relationship by trying out different programs that might bring the staff together. So in our report, we talk about an initiative in Texas that actually allowed the veterans organization staff to help the VA in increasing the claims processing speed. And Lael can talk more about this, but finding ways in which the two staffs can work together and really take advantage of the resources that are available to them. So this would not only help to improve the process, but also signals the importance of collaboration and also may lead to a better way to process claims in the future.
But what can you tell us about the third strategy you developed in your report? And what actions do you outline that can be taken to implement it?
So the third strategy that we outline is build trust through honest communication and access. So this is, about making sure that everyone is on the same page. One really important way to do this is through meetings, through having regularly scheduled meetings so everyone knows what's going on in the regional office. So one example is that one regional office, there was a technical problem in the computer system, and claims were showing up as paid when they were not. And so VA Veterans Organization personnel were getting all kinds of calls about what was going on. The veterans are saying that this shows that my claim is paid. It definitely has not been paid. But the VO personnel were not informed that this was just a computer glitch. And so they weren't able to, really quickly relay to the veterans that this is what was going on and that this was going to be fixed. Instead, it took them a lot of time to kind of figure out and determine what was actually going on so that then they could get back to the veterans. And it just, there was a lot of frustration and tension that kind of built because that they didn't know exactly what was going on. And this all could have been allayed if they had just been informed about the computer glitch so that they could then tell veterans to, that everything was okay, that, no one thought that their claim had been paid. And that just would have, allowed everyone to kind of be on the same page. And instead of, the veterans organizations not really having a clue about what was going on in the organization. Another thing is building a trust or honest communication. Part of this is also explaining denials. So we heard a lot of veterans organizations staff say that if the VA, they would appreciate it if the VA personnel would just explain maybe or give them a brief understanding of why they denied something. Because if they don't give any explanation, so then sometimes veterans organization personnel can take it that it's just kind of a denial first culture or that there's something going on in that sense. Another strategy for having this, kind of honest communication and providing access simultaneously is structuring the lines of communication. So Lael talked before about having the supervisor first policy. We heard a lot about how this was really useful in allowing the veterans organizations to still talk and have access to the VA personnel, but maybe not slow them down in their claims processing. Also, we heard that having the managers of the VA have an open door policy really helped because then the veterans organization personnel felt that they could always go and see the director if they needed to. Not that they would want to use that all the time, but if they thought that they always had access to the director and the director was there to listen to them, then they felt that, they had a way in which to resolve any issues that came to them. And that also was part and parcel with holding regularly scheduled meetings so that there was a place in which they could talk about problems that they saw, but also talk about problems that they saw in a more systematic way so they could see if there were patterns with certain claims that they saw were particularly problematic, then there was a regularly scheduled meeting at which they could discuss those issues. So those are the kind of things that we saw with building trust through honest communication and access.
Strategy 4 reveals the importance of building trust through expertise and joint training. Would you elaborate on this strategy and the actions you've outlined that can make it happen?
So when we talk to the veterans organizations and the VA personnel, they emphasize the expertise of the other group and talking and how important it was that the other group knew what they're doing and had the necessary training in order to serve as a resource, particularly for the veteran service organizations. One way to do this is through taking advantage of informal training opportunities. And so this comes with maybe the VA personnel could explain denials. So if there is a reason that they deny the claim and they see this maybe as a pattern in a lot of claims, they could take the time then to explain why they denied something. And that could lead to the veteran service officers having a better understanding of why this claim was denied. And then they would maybe stop using that as a reasoning in future claims. They could also do this through meetings. So in meetings, if the VA personnel saw a particular pattern in the claims, if there was a particular pattern or there's a problem, they could bring it up in a meeting, and then it wouldn't become a session about just talking about one particular claim, but they could use one particular claim to illustrate a pattern that they were seeing and then use that as a way to kind of teach the veteran service officers about a better way to maybe handle this particular issue. Another thing that we heard a lot about was offering joint training sessions. This has worked in some regional offices. So some regional offices talked about the VA personnel and the VSO personnel coming together and getting joint training together. And this is a way that's going to increase the expertise of both groups and also gives them an opportunity to interact and understand that both groups do have this training and so that they can be used as a resource, particularly for the VA seeing the VSOs as having a lot of training and being knowledgeable about what's going on in the program.
So, professors, what is the fifth and final strategy you outline in your report?
Sure. So the fifth strategy was to serve as honest brokers. And Lael talked about this before. Really, this applies to both the VA personnel and to the VSO personnel. So the quality collaborative relationship cannot really survive if government employees view outreach organization employees as advising claimants in a less than honest manner. So maybe trying to get them to claim for every possible issue, even though there's maybe not legitimate medical evidence for a particular issue. Or if the VA personnel see the veterans service officers as appealing every decision, regardless of the merit of the actual decision. But the collaborative relationship is also difficult if outreach organization employees view government employees as denying every claim that comes their way, regardless of merit. So employees in both organizations need to be aware and do everything they can to serve as honest brokers and kind of thinking about their role as being bigger than maybe just working for the particular veteran that they're filing the claim for or that they're processing the claim for, but as their role as serving all veterans, particularly for the veteran service organization. So they could try to get the most that they possibly could for a particular veteran, which is, of course, what they should do within the regulations. But they can also make sure to be honest with veterans when a particular claim maybe doesn't have the medical evidence necessary in order to link it to military service, for example. So veterans organizations can be honest, and then that helps to kind of speed up the entire process. If the VA personnel don't have to go through a lot of claims and then ultimately deny them. So in order to get the full benefit of collaboration, then outreach organizations must instill in their workers the importance of being honest with potential claimants about how their situation does or not does not fit within the eligibility rules, as well as what they file, as well as how what they file will create potential delays in their cases. And outreach organizations must be honest with government personnel about applications. On the other hand, government agencies can inculcate a culture of fair and accurate claims processing, which gives each case do and communicate to outreach organizations that they're doing so. And so making sure that they're not developing or portraying or giving the appearance of a denial first culture. And that could be really helpful in kind of showing both sides that they have this honest broker mentality.
Can I just add one thing to that is that the outreach organizations
Sure. In
the VA were also very clear to indicate that it's really up to the veteran about what they want to file for. So while an honest broker would mean that the VSO would inform them of what the regulations are and what they need to meet, what evidence they need to meet the eligibility criteria, ultimately it's the veteran's decision about what they file for. And if a veteran wants to file for something, the VSO will help that veteran file for it. So it's not that the VSO would sort of deny a veteran the right to file for something that they really truly wanted to file for. It was just that they need to inform the veteran that, you know, this is what the regulations are, you know, and then the veteran makes the ultimate decision.
Yes, I think that. And so what Lael said was absolutely correct, that all veteran service organization personnel told us that they ultimately do what the veteran wants, but they can kind of help to explain the veteran the regulations and indicate that this may not fit exactly within the regulations.
And now I'd like to understand, what prompted your research in this area? Would you tell us about how you conducted the research for this report and who participated and why?
Sure. So what prompted our research was we were really interested in the topic. We kept reading a lot about a lot of news stories about the backlog.